Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has offered to take over the complex and labor-intensive process of contact tracing after someone becomes sick with the coronavirus, and Bloomberg is putting up more than $10 million to help do so. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Cuomo and health experts believe that contact tracing will be very important during a predicted second wave or even a third wave of the virus. Along with more widespread testing of those who are experiencing symptoms, the method can help isolate those who are at risk of becoming sick or spreading the virus without having to shut down the entire economy. The governor says details still need to be worked out. He says no one has ever attempted contact tracing on such a large scale. He calls it a monumental effort that will also involve coordination with New York City and its suburbs, upstate regions, and neighboring states.
Michael Bloomberg will design the program, design the training. He's going to make a financial contribution also, put together an organization that can help hire the people, because we have to expand this number tenfold, and get this all done like this. This has to happen. You don't have months to plan and do this. You have weeks to get this up and running.
Cuomo's chief of staff, Melissa DeRosa, says Bloomberg won't be doing it all alone. He'll be working with Johns Hopkins University, which issues the definitive map of coronavirus cases worldwide.
Which he funds very heavily, their public health program, which is preeminent in the country. He's helping us to design the programmatic, operational, and technological components of our contact tracing program. And they, in partnership with us, are creating an online curriculum to train the tracers, to recruit them, to interview, to perform the background checks. And then we're going to coordinate all of the counties and also with New Jersey and Connecticut.
The state will also be recruiting people to work as tracers through existing health department staff, investigators who work at state agencies, and medical students at State and City University of New York medical schools. Cuomo says they'll probably have to hire more people than that. He says if successful, it can serve as a model for other states. In a statement, Bloomberg said while people are eager to begin loosening restrictions on their daily lives and the economy, they need to do it safely and have to first put in place systems to identify people who may have been exposed to the virus and support them as they isolate. State health officials have also been trying to get more data about the rate of infection that's already occurred among New Yorkers. They've been conducting random tests at grocery stores around the state to see if shoppers might have the antibodies in their blood and to show that they already contracted the virus and recovered. Cuomo says it's the largest study in the country and will hopefully put to rest speculation on what has been the actual spread of the disease in the U.S. so far.
What percent of the population has been infected? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. I think this. Yeah, it's nice what you think. What's the fact? Nobody knows the fact.
The results will not be known for several more days. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, this week, had quite a conversation with Governor Andrew Cuomo. Let's start with
his meeting with President Trump in Washington.
Well, I kept asking him, I don't know how you can go in and look at that guy and his staff who's with him, including none other than Jared Kushner, of all people, and, you know, keep a straight face and not want to, get into a major confrontation with the guy. He said, look, we're all grown ups. We know we have to get this thing done. We are. I talked to him about testing. I want more testing, and I want the federal government to help. And he said that he would do that. This is the kind of difficult situation that Cuomo is in. On the one hand, you know, he has to tell the American people when he thinks that Trump is out of line, which is quite frequently. And on the other hand, he has to do what's right for the people of New York in terms of getting some help here. And the president apparently told him he would. So we'll see. The president's game is a difficult one. On the one hand, talk about mixed messaging. He tells the American people, we got to open things up, we got to open things up. So then the obedient, I keep that word in black letters and quotation marks, the obedient governor of Georgia says, okay, chief, we'll open things up. Then everybody comes down like a ton of bricks, the mayors in Georgia and everybody else, and they really get angry at him, and they're polling all the time in the White House, that I can tell you, and uh-oh, boss, people don't like this. So now he comes out, and what does he do? He criticizes the governor of Georgia for doing what basically he opened the door to. It's disgusting. It is the kind of leadership or lack of leadership that we have in this country. And for me, I just can't figure this guy out. You know, this is a time when you need strong leadership, when you need decency, and we're not getting any of it. You know, they fire the head of their major medical service who is going into the creation of a vaccine, and he tells the truth. The president is asked about it. He says, I don't even know this guy. Well, if you don't know him, why don't you know him if he's in charge of creating a vaccine, which is the most important thing in America? So we have the ongoing Trump circus and lack of leadership in this country. It is just beyond belief.
And he's fomented these protests. Liberate, he was saying to the states. Well, it happened in Albany, New York, not Georgia. Albany, New York yesterday. Protesters outside the state capitol demanding Governor Cuomo reopen New York State. The governor talked about those protesters, saying he gets the economic hardship. Everybody feels it. The illness is death. What is worse than death, he says?
You know what? It was a very impressive moment. Look, Cuomo is a very smart man, and what he is doing here is that while he's saying, you know, I don't want anybody to die, and death is worse than anything else that anybody could be experiencing right now, he does say that in some parts of the state, he puts Western New York under Kathy Hochul, and in some parts of the state, he'll be doing some opening. So on the one hand, he says, look, I'm the governor. I'm to blame. You got a problem. Don't bring it to your local officials. Bring it to me because I've made these decisions and these are mine to make. And he does a superb job of making the case that he doesn't want anybody to die. And on the other hand, he says, okay, in some ways, we'll be open to some of this as we go along.
Allen Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell Wednesday insisted that flailing state and local government should be able to use the bankruptcy route rather than receive aid from the federal government, signaling renewed opposition to the top Democratic demand for the next coronavirus relief package.
David, I talked to the governor about this, and I said he had said this, and the governor was both dismissive and awed by the chutzpah of McConnell. I truly believe McConnell is one of the worst politicians in America. I just think his lack of caring should put him ahead of the pack when it comes to making that assessment. So I asked the governor about it. The governor just sort of toyed with it like a cat with a toy and then just threw it away. You know, for McConnell to say, hey, we don't have to help the states. We can have them declare bankruptcy and leave people with debt and everything else. That is so extraordinarily mean and stupid. Maybe the fact that McConnell's wife is in the cabinet, maybe it's that he wants all those federal judgeships and Trump has been delivering them for him. Nevertheless, it is unbelievable that he would open his mouth and that those words would come out of it.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Colleges and universities were some of the first to close because of the coronavirus pandemic. To comply with social distancing guidelines, campuses moved online for the rest of the spring semester. Many students headed for spring break and never came back, except to move out. With the initial shock of the pandemic waning, students and administrators are now focused on how to move forward. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports.
Instead of packed parking lots and teams of RAs loading moving bins, students moving out at SUNY Oneonta saw quiet halls and empty streets. The public college in Oneonta essentially shuttered its doors during an extended spring break on March 17th. Since then, its more than 6,000 students have been returning in shifts to clear out their dorms. Music industry and mass communication senior Natalie Costanza.
It was kind of very lonely, to be completely honest. You actually had to text a number to say that you were coming in, and then you had to sign up for a move-out time. My roommates all had moved out earlier than I did, so I was completely alone. It was like, wow, this is how things are shaking up after all this amazing time. This is how things have to end.
College spokesperson Kim McLeod says about 80 students remain on campus. Costanza didn't qualify to stay, but rather than go home to Rochester, she's moving into a spare room at a friend's apartment in town. As of Monday, three SUNY Oneonta employees have tested positive for COVID-19, at least one of whom was quarantined on campus prior to testing. McLeod says the school is disinfecting doorknobs, desks, and other high-touch areas throughout its buildings and helping the Otsego County Department of Health with contact tracing. She notes students who have left will be refunded or credited the remaining room and board for the semester.
This is for the housing fees and meal plans based on the time when they left campus till the end of the spring term, so it will depend on when they've left. We also offer an emergency fund that's designed to help students pay for urgent expenses. You know, we're trying to help them in every way possible to make sure that they will just focus on their studies and not worry about some of these other things.
McLeod maintains the college has enough reserve funds to weather the reimbursements and the shutdown, but that certainly isn't the case everywhere. Earlier this month, Amherst College in Massachusetts estimated the pandemic could cost the school more than $10 million. Albany's College of St. Rose, already facing a financial shortfall, recently furloughed 61 employees and reduced salaries for non-unionized staff to bring a $15.8 million deficit down to $13.5 million. And in light of an up to $10 million deficit, the Vermont State College's Board of Trustees is considering consolidating and closing some of its campuses.
Hello, Future Hawks. My name is Neva, and I'm currently standing in Breezy Hall. We are soon about to celebrate our 225 years, making Harwick College one of the oldest colleges in the country.
Across the street from SUNY Oneonta, Hartwick College demonstrates how colleges are projecting optimism. It recently held its annual spring open house and accepted Students Day online, with roughly 270 prospective students and parents tuning in for virtual tours and Q&As with teachers, coaches, and financial advisors on Zoom. Such events are usually the last chance for colleges to make their pitch to accepted students before Decision Day on May 1st. Karen McGrath, Vice President for Enrollment Management and Student Experience, says Hartwick's admissions office started filming tours and promos early on in the outbreak.
It's going to help us continue to build our electronic content so we can leverage it over the rest of the recruiting cycle and into next year. So, you know, some of the content that we've been able to create, we'll be able to send to students who live 3,000 miles away. So there are going to be some real positives that come out of this that are going just to become other pieces of our recruiting strategy moving forward.
What's going on, Oneonta? You're listening to Red Dragon Radio. You're listening to Alec Felder Radio for the last time. Today's the last ever episode of Houses in Motion. I know, I'm sad too. I'd rather be home. Because if I'm going to be quarantined, I might as well be quarantined with my dog.
SUNY Oneonta's campus radio station, WONY, is the main reason Natalie Costanza stayed behind. The studio is still open to a few off-campus seniors who want to go on air, and other DJs have been hosting shifts from home. As general manager, Costanza wants to make sure everything runs smoothly and stays clean. She says online classes have been going well, although most of her production classes have been completely reworked to adjust for the lack of studios and other facilities. Even with nowhere to go and not much to do, Costanza says the biggest obstacle remains focusing.
You have due dates, but you do everything on your own time. My first choice to do my work would be to go to a library or to a coffee shop because I've never been somebody who can study in my room. I've always had to go to a space.
To lighten the load, McLeod says SUNY Oneonta students have been given the choice to have their classes graded on a pass-fail basis, which won't impact their overall GPA. SUNY Oneonta's spring commencement has been moved to the end of August, and Costanza says she's on a committee that hopes to reschedule remaining senior events as well. Like most seniors, even under normal circumstances, she's a little bittersweet about graduating. She's going to miss her last couple weeks with friends and her senior recital with the campus dance company, but otherwise she has no regrets.
I'm glad that I didn't wait to do anything in college. I got involved very early on. I feel like I was able to do a majority of things that I wanted to do.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jessie King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. During the pandemic, much of daily life has moved online. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports, working and learning from home requires a variety of adjustments.
When Americans were sent home for safety, the internet became the hub of human activity. Students had to adjust to remote learning. People who didn't lose their jobs started working from home. Those who did lose their jobs turned to the internet to apply for unemployment, seek out entertainment like games, movies, and music videos, and more recently, visiting the IRS website to try and determine the status of their stimulus check. Dr. Nicole Berkins is a best-selling author and clinical psychologist.
We're seeing that there's been 105% leap in digital homeschooling and 65% increase in online communication versus video games and social media. So the good news is that kids in the U.S. And in Europe seem to be using a lot of the time that they're online right now for not only learning kinds of things, but also to keep in touch with friends and family. So that certainly is a promising thing.
As school districts and colleges scramble to support new demand for online presence, local governments stepped in to assist those in need. Hudson, New York Mayor Kamal Johnson distributed 50 free Wi-Fi hotspots to student households lacking internet access.
Families receive a phone, they're getting it connected, and all they have to do is plug it into the charger, and they're ready to go right on to the internet.
Similarly, Albany County Executive Dan McCoy was able to fast-track a long-planned rural broadband initiative. The service is a big step up from dial-up internet. Some 300 students will be granted access at no charge. Other households eventually will be able to subscribe.
We're going to work the cost out and make sure we pick that bill up so that they don't have to worry about it if they don't have the means to pay for it.
Guilderland School District was the first to shut down in the Albany area, where Dr. Marie Wiles is superintendent.
We have recreated school out of the ether. Every single system, every single way that we operate, we've had to rethink in the last month. I could not say enough about not only the work of our own faculty and staff in Guilderland, but across the region, there has been tremendous leadership in having school districts work together to solve some of these unanswered problems and to coordinate curriculum and to share teaching resources. The Capital Region BOCES has been instrumental in coordinating the work among 23 school districts, and that work has been shared across the state. SUNY Albany, the School of Education, has put together a tremendous repository of resources for teaching and learning. So the resources have materialized in remarkable speed. They are high quality, they are engaging. They're not the same as being at school.
Dr. Berkins has concerns as online time ramps up.
The downsides of so much screen time and device use, can come in the form of not only some physical issues with being more sedentary, but also just the mental health and the behavioral issues that we see for children, especially around spending so much time on screen.
Add that to the pressure on parents of being cooped up, working from home, or just being furloughed at home, managing kids who need to be attending class online, all the while worrying about catching COVID-19. It can be a pressure cooker of emotions. Albany County Department of Mental Health Director Dr. Stephen Giordano invites anyone having difficulty dealing with coronavirus-related issues to call.
518-269-6634. We have volunteers and staff members manning it 7 days a week. I would just say that it's a mental health support line, and although we'll handle anything that comes in, we have had to direct a few calls to other sources.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Dr. Michelle Tagati's research focuses on the function of positive emotions in the coping process. She says humans are well equipped with internal tools readily available to help us be resilient and overcome the stresses and anxieties caused by the global COVID-19 crisis. Tagati is a professor in the Department of Psychological Science at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, where she directs the Effective Science Laboratory, investigating the science of emotions, coping, and resilience. She spoke with the Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn.
What I'm interested in my work is to see whether positive emotions have a capacity to help fuel resilience. So our bodies, and when we're experiencing stress, the heightened levels of stress that we're experiencing, our bodies activate the sympathetic nervous system. Our blood pressure increases, our heart rate increases, respiration increases. And what this is doing is preparing our bodies for action. And in this way, negative emotions are actually quite useful. It draws our attention to what we need to focus on. It gives us information about how to solve problems at that moment. But what positive emotions do, it also has a very important function. And it gives our bodies the time to restore and recover and replenish after this heightened level of stress. We need to give our bodies that time. So what positive emotions do is it helps us recover from that sympathetic activation, allowing us that pause, a breather, so that we can build up our resilience muscle in some way so that we can cope more effectively with the stressors that are constantly coming our way. Social connection is something that's very important. When we experience negative emotions like stress and anxiety, that actually activates our desire to connect with other individuals. It's one of our greatest human strengths is to help and to give and to connect in ways that is so important to us. We want to comfort other individuals when we're feeling stress, and we want to be comforted ourselves. What this is doing is activating a hormone called oxytocin. And it's a stress hormone, but at the same time, it signals our desire to connect. In the time of this global pandemic, however, we're faced with a challenge of not having the usual outlets for connection, like hugging others, being close, having this togetherness that our bodies actually crave. So what we need to do now is come up with innovative and creative ways of connecting with others.
Which, she says, we've been doing a lot online, through video chats, yoga classes, and symphony offerings.
When we're connecting with others, it helps to downregulate or help people recover from the heightened blood pressure or cortisol levels that are elevated. And it also has a natural anti-inflammatory effect. So one of the consequences is that it helps people feel less pain, and it reduces any cardiovascular damage or stress that's elicited from the stress of cardiovascular ramp-up during stressful experiences.
You've studied positive emotions post 9/11, and maybe you could talk about that and how that compares to now.
A lot of people are making the connection now, or at least it brings to mind 9/11, because this was something that was completely unexpected and unpredicted. What we were doing at the time, we were in the middle of a study, was collecting data in graduate school, and in the midst of that, 9/11 happened. And what we were able to do was to track people's emotions before and after this national tragedy. What we found was, even in the midst of this heightened level of stress and anxiety and adversity, some individuals were able to report positive emotions, like gratitude for their loved ones, love that for people that they cared about, and interest in what was happening in the world. So people who are able to experience positive emotions, even in the midst of this tragedy, had better outcomes months later. They had shorter durations of depression, fewer depression symptoms, and they were more optimistic about their ability to cope with future stressors. And that's important, that optimism to cope is important, because we're seeing it now. People are reflecting back. How did they get through that? If they were able to get through that, perhaps they can utilize the same strategies in the world we're living in today.
Will you be looking to do the same with this pandemic?
Yeah, we're looking at how people are responding in the midst of stress. So looking at what are the positive emotions that are elicited. If we ask people to cultivate experiences of gratitude, what are some of the outcomes? What are they doing naturally in the face of this event? Are they connecting with others with humor, you know, sharing funny jokes or memes? Or are they connecting and eliciting greater and deeper connections with loved ones and their partners, et cetera? So seeing what people are doing naturally and measuring outcomes and their ability to cope down the line as a follow-up would be great.
Is there anything else you wanted to mention, Michelle?
I think that one of the things that we're starting to see is that there's a lot of global and national cooperation and compassion. I think that's really important to consider in these particularly trying times. So allowing individuals to understand that we have a common humanity, that we're all in this together, we're all experiencing this type of suffering, but to acknowledge that with acceptance rather than resistance is one way that to have a resilient mindset, to be able to recognize that these will ultimately become redemptive moments that can define us.
Dr. Michelle Tugadi is a professor in the Department of Psychological Science at Poughkeepsie-based Vassar College, where she directs the Effective Science Laboratory.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That number, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2017. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.